I know it's commonplace for preachers to begin with something a bit light-hearted or a story, but I'm going to pitch straight in on a not quite a light-hearted note this morning. Let me ask you a serious question. Do you feel imprisoned in some way? Do you feel imprisoned in some way? Maybe you feel imprisoned in your job. You don't feel it's going anywhere. You don't find it fulfilling. You'd rather be somewhere else. Maybe you feel imprisoned by some difficulty or some handicap. It restricts you and hampers you and stops you doing what you want to do. Maybe you feel imprisoned in your marriage. There are all different kinds of imprisonments, aren't there? How should you live if you find yourself in such a situation? Well, I don't say that you should simply put up with it, or that you should not pray for a change in your circumstances. But insofar, or for as long as that constraint, that prison, if you like, is upon you, God can use you in that situation. And indeed, it may be that there is no one else but God to use other than you in that situation. The Apostle Paul spent about 5.5 years in prison or under house arrest, one or the other. And there's no reason to think that Paul didn't pray for his release and pray for a change in his circumstances. I'm quite sure he probably did. But we also know that whilst he was in prison, he wrote some of the greatest contributions to the New Testament. He wrote 4 of his letters while he was in prison. One of them, the letter we're going to look at shortly, Paul's letter to the Colossians. John Bunyan spent 12 years in prison, and during that time he wrote some of his greatest books and pamphlets. But rather than seeing his imprisonment as an impediment, he took an optimistic view, and he once said this: "I have been too long away from my writing," he said. Maybe this is not so much a prison as an office from which I can reach the world with Christ's message. He refused to see his imprisonment as something that would constrain him totally. He saw the opportunity that it gave him to write and broadcast what was on his heart to many more people than he otherwise would have done. Winston Churchill came out with some great things from time to time, didn't he? He once said this: "A pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity, while the optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty." I wonder what you are. Do you tend towards being a pessimist or an optimist? Which way do you kind of go? I've got a theory that we're all kind of predisposed to be generally one or the other, depending on a number of factors, character traits, our upbringing, and life experiences, which can perhaps steer us in one way or the other. We're probably all lean to being one or the other. But if we do tend towards pessimism, I really believe that we don't have to stay that way. I like the story of 2 shoe salesmen who were sent by the company to an African country to open up new markets for their shoes. After 6 months, one wrote back, "I'm coming home. It's useless here. No one in Africa wears shoes." I apologize that that is a caricature. Not actually true today. I'm going back a few years. One wrote back and said, "Oh, I'm coming home. It's hopeless here. Nobody in Africa wears shoes." At about the same time, the other one wrote back and said, "Send more stock. Everybody in Africa needs shoes." If you're in a difficult situation, of course, cry out to God for help, for strength, for a change in your circumstances. But in the meantime, ask God to show you the positives. Well, that's by way of introduction to this marvelous letter to the Colossians, written by Paul from prison in AD 62. And I'm going to look at verses 15 to 20 of the first chapter, and what remarkable verses they are. In fact, what we have in these verses is quite probably one of the earliest creeds of the church. Now, of course, it's not the Baptist tradition generally to say a creed week in and week out like the Anglicans do, but there's a precedence for it. Almost certainly, in several places in the New Testament, we have Paul quoting early creeds that were said regularly by the believers when they met. There's one in Philippians 2. There's one in 1 Timothy chapter 3. There's another in 1 Corinthians 15. And there's another one probably here in Colossians chapter 1 as well. Just listen to these verses and note the rhythm. And remember, we're probably here reciting words that have been recited for thousands of years, including by some of the very earliest Christians. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and things on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. I don't think Paul would probably have just written that off the top of his head. I do think he was quoting some words that had been carefully crafted to try and summarize some of the great truths of the Christian faith, and he was passing them on to a new group of believers who lived in Colossae. Now, it would take much longer than we've got to unpack everything that Paul says in those few verses, so I'm going to pick out three things for brief comment. Firstly, we're told here that Jesus created all things. Verse 16, for by him, Jesus, all things were created. Now, we usually think of God the Father as the creator, but clearly Jesus had a role in creation too. And of course, that's exactly what John says in his gospel. He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Through him, all things were made, and there was nothing that was made without him that was not made. Jesus is the creator. Think back to that picture I showed a little earlier in the service. I wonder whether you, like me, sometimes feel utterly gobsmacked by the universe and by creation, by its beauty and its vastness, from the intricacy of the tiniest creatures to the immensity of the universe. Did you know that the known universe, that's what we can currently see and more or less measure, we know there's more, but we can't quite get at it yet. The known universe stretches for 47 billion light years in every direction. So we're standing here in Harrogate. The universe stretches for 47 billion light years in that direction, and 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 in that direction. The known universe is 94 billion light years in diameter. Now, perhaps you don't quite know what a light year is, although I'm sure many of you do. A light year is as far as you can travel in 365 days, travelling at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. Can you get your head around that? Let me put it another way. You get in your car after the service this morning, and you really put your foot down, and you set off at 186,000 miles per second. Don't worry about the police, they'll never see you. Just imagine two policemen sitting in their Panda and all of a I say, Fred, did you see something? No, George, didn't see a thing. Imagine that. So you put your foot down and you really set off and you travel at 186,000 miles per second for 365 days and nights. And at that point, you will have traveled one light year. And all you've got to do is repeat that 47 billion times, and you will have reached the edge of the known universe. So as I said earlier, if the universe is that great, how much greater must the Creator of the universe be? And Jesus, along with God the Father and God the Holy Spirit, created it. And that's why we can say, as Paul does here in Colossians, by Jesus all things were created. Ah, but you might say, there's a bit of a problem there. If God is such an awesome, mind-boggling creator, surely he is way beyond our understanding or even our imagination. We can't really imagine the universe properly. How can we imagine the one who made it? Well, actually, that's not quite right. Because the second thing we can take from these few verses here in Colossians is in verse 15. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. We do know what God is like. We do. Because Jesus has shown us. Now, this is really interesting. In ancient times, mirrors were made out of highly polished metal. And they gave a reasonably good, but not a perfect, representation of whoever was looking into it. But in the first century, during St. Paul's lifetime, the Romans invented glass mirrors, which do give a perfect representation of whoever is looking into it. And it's tempting to think that Paul was aware of this, and that what he was getting at in Colossians, he was really saying this: Jesus is the exact image, the precise reflection of God. But I suppose one might still argue, yes, but an image or a reflection, no matter how accurate, still isn't the real thing. I mean, a photograph or a painting might be very, very lifelike, but it's not the real thing. You haven't got the real thing there in front of you, have you? And so in verse 19, Paul adds this: for God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, Jesus. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in Jesus. Jesus was completely full. This is clumsy language, but what can you say? Jesus was completely full of God. His attributes, his character, his perfection, his holiness, his power, his love. You couldn't get any more of God into Jesus if you tried. All the fullness of God dwelt in him. He was much more than just a painting or a photograph or a reflection. He was the real deal, if you like. And again, That's exactly what John said in his gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Three great truths that Paul gives us in Colossians chapter 1. By Jesus, all things were created, including this vast, mind-boggling, spellbinding universe of which we are just a tiny, tiny part. Jesus is the image, the exact image of the invisible God. And God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in Jesus. And if that isn't amazing enough, Paul says this a little bit later. We didn't have this read earlier, but in chapter 1, verse 27, Paul says this: God has chosen to make known among the Gentiles, that's me and you, God has chosen to make known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of this mystery, which is Christ in you. So the whole of God lives in Jesus, and Jesus, by his Spirit, lives in us. That should surely impact our thinking, our behavior, our speech, our priorities, our ambitions, our hopes, our desires. These fantastic truths should surely impact everything about us. I began by asking whether you feel imprisoned or constrained in some way. And I don't want to make light of the very difficult situations that some people are coping with. But we should be like the Apostle Paul or John Bunyan and look for what we can do rather than what we can't do. And remember this: God lives in Jesus, and Jesus lives in us. Let's have a few moments of quiet reflection.